This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi everyone, aside from our usual filthy language, in this episode we talk about murder, obviously, but also suicidality and self-harm. So if those things are triggers for you, please feel free to skip. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Little Miss Recap, the podcast where we love us a good crime, but we really only like solved murders. I only like solved murders. How do you feel about this?
Yeah, it's nice when there's like a bow on it in the end, although I think there's a little open-ended pieces to this one.
I think so, too. Guys, I'm Amy Archer. I'm your host, and I'm here today with backdoor friend Chubnum. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about you so that we could get to know you a little bit and why you are so interested in true crime?
Yeah. So I am from the San Francisco area and I'm a lawyer. I've spent most of my career working at tech companies as in-house counsel, but I'm very much a fan of reality TV and true crime documentaries, shows, and all that. So I actually started listening to Little Miss Recap last fall when the Sister Wives phenomenon of season 18 got into full effect. And I've been a fan ever since. So I'm so excited awesome. To be here. I'm kind of fangirling talking to you.
Oh, please. All right. So we wanted to talk a little bit about Unlocked. So you're watching it. I'm watching it. But we both only watched two episodes, right?
Yeah. I only watched two episodes.
Okay. What are your thoughts?
My first thought was that all of the women that work in this prison are extremely hot and go to the same bad lash place. So that was yes. my first thought. Yes. But it's definitely an interesting experiment. I'm surprised it lasted past the 24 hours where I'm at.
Me too.
So that's promising, but
me too. I didn't really watch any further just because I don't know like if this is something that I want to cover, but it's so fascinating to me as somebody who is just so interested in human dynamics, like watching mm-hmm. the hierarchy evolve. And it was so fascinating. Randy, guys, skip ahead if you don't want to hear spoilers, but Randy, the uh-huh. elder who seems yeah. to right away want to take control, he was so fascinating to me because if you think about it, he's quote unquote like, standing up as the leader and taking control, but he's doing all this bad stuff too. Like he's yeah. having people beat up.
Yeah. And that was interesting. I found it really interesting that he had someone beat up right before the experiment to kind of be like, I'm the head of this household of jail and everybody better fall in line.
Yes. So, it's yeah. kind of like when they tell, because I'm obsessed with prison because my biggest fear is being wrongfully convicted and imprisoned. Uh-huh. And I understand yeah. as like a middle-aged white lady in Scranton, Pennsylvania, the odds of that happening are very slim. But I've always kind of been very fearful of it. And so what did they tell you? Always beat the shit out of the biggest person there, right as you get in.
Oh, interesting.
And that'll, you know, I probably learned that like on The Sopranos or something ridiculous. Yeah. But I couldn't beat up anybody, first of all.
Yeah,
so
me too.
I like the way Randy operates, and he just has other people do it for him.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. He's a mastermind.
Yeah, and also I was trying to tell Timmy, my husband, about this, because I'm like, what was so interesting about it is the older generation, they're like, you know, we demand respect, we demand authority, we're going to be the bosses, this is how it's set up. And the younger generation, they're like, you can't do this. And they almost, I could have sworn, I think I might be making this up, but I could have sworn I heard somebody say, like, we need to nominate people to be the leaders here.
Yeah. You know, it was funny because I started thinking, I'm like, this is sort of how society works, right? Where like the old people are like, this is how we're going to run the country and this is what we're going to do. And all the young people are like, no, you can't do this. We have to have a voice. So it's kind of interesting to see those same kind of things develop in a prison setting.
Absolutely. Like if you look at, are you a millennial? You're a millennial, right?
Yeah. I'm an older millennial, 80s baby, 90s kid.
Yeah. So millennials and certainly Gen Z, but definitely millennials too. Like you guys were raised that you have a voice.
Yeah.
And when that voice is threatened or taken away, like, and I know because I taught millennials for years, for a decade, and it's like they have a voice and my kids have a voice and I want them to have a voice because we didn't. We were just like, shut up and, you know, go play out in the yard for 17 hours. So it is interesting to see these guys reacting. Now, there are some douchebags on the show. Mm-hmm. I forget their names, but like the two younger guys who are hiding contraband and shit in their bunk. And they're like, they're just, I don't like that one guy. Mm.
Well, are you talking about the guy who the iguana bit his dick when he was doing his crime? Because
That's the guy.
I was like, if that story is not real, you should get him for the podcast when he comes out. Cause he told that so beautifully.
That's the guy. And there's a couple that I'm like, I just don't like these guys at all. I will say there were a few that I definitely would have dated in my 20s, 110%.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting. I'm going to keep watching. Guys, let us know if you want us to talk about it further, but it's fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's it really is. I'm definitely going to continue to watch.
Know what it reminded me of? Did you ever see the Vice episode where Eric Holder and Barack Obama go to the jail and they talk with the inmates for like an hour?
I didn't see that, but that sounds interesting.
Eric Holder is like all about prison reform. Like that's his thing. Like he's been doing that for a long time. In fact, when this sheriff came in and was talking to the inmates, I was like, God, he sounds like Eric Holder. Like it was wild. I thought maybe it was him. But that's his passion project. And there was a really good documentary about him. And Obama was the first sitting president to ever go visit a prison system. And it was good. It was really, really good.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's talk about what we're here to talk about today. So we're talking about the 2024, is it Netflix?
Yeah, Netflix.
I think so, right? Netflix doc, What Jennifer Did. So what are your overall thoughts of this documentary?
Well, the title is really anticlimactic. They really left no mystery there. That it would have been nice to have a little more mystery. I thought the first half or so was pretty like boring and slow, but it really got interesting towards the second half where kind of the story starts to unravel.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't love it either. Mm-hmm. I felt like, okay, well, what's the, like, it's a very, so I'm being hypocritical because I just said I like all crime solved, but I also like a little bit of gray, you know what I mean? I don't feel like she clearly did it. Yeah. She's like, it's solved. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. There's no, why did she do it? Or was somebody else in on it? Like, I feel like it's pretty straightforward.
I think so, but I think there's kind of a little more to like maybe what were exactly her intentions that night. Did she maybe want them to pretend to kill her so she could run away with Danny? Or did she really just want her parents murdered? I think there's a little bit of gray.
There's a lot that the documentary didn't include that I looked up, and I'm sure you did too because you did some research.
Yeah.
All right. So let's start. So the doc opens with her being interrogated by police. We hear the 911 call. What are your thoughts on listening to 911 calls? I know it's a weird question.
Yeah. I mean, I think 911 calls are overall are really interesting. She, like, even in her 911 call and in her first interview with the police, I felt like she really didn't seem as sort of distraught as I would have expected, which makes sense given that she was part of the crime. Yeah. But I was sort of surprised at that. She seemed like remarkably composed for someone who's a victim.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like 911 calls are like us at just like our most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I hate when they're made public.
Yeah, I could see that. That definitely does make sense.
I remember when Sandy Hook happened and a few months afterwards, there was somebody who, is it a Freedom of Information Act to get those released? Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody who was trying to get the 911 calls released from the school. And they did. And I remember like Anderson Cooper on air and he was like, we're not airing them. Like I refuse to. We're not doing it. And I just remember being like, thank God, because I couldn't hear that. And so like it feels, I don't know.
Yeah, that is different. I feel like what is the purpose of that? Like with Jennifer's, it's makes a lot more sense. Okay, she ends up actually being involved. And so we kind of want to hear how this all started. But definitely doesn't make sense for Sandy Hook.
Yeah, I feel that way even with the World Trade Center situation. Like, remember they were releasing the calls from that Flight 93 or whatever?
Yeah.
The people like calling their spouses and stuff. And they were releasing those. And I couldn't hear them.
Yeah.
Like, it's so hard for me to hear that. And there's a show on ID Network called, what is it called? Like, it's a show that's all about surveillance. They solved the crime through surveillance. I forget what it's called. See No Evil. See No Evil.
Oh, okay. Oh, interesting.
And I can't watch that show because the surveillance footage is all real. And I'm like, you're watching somebody like walking to where they're about to get murdered. And I can't watch that. It's too difficult for me. I'd rather a cheesy Lifetime reenactment.
Definitely.
If I have to see a crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she's crying hysterical on the 911 call. She's saying she doesn't know where her parents are. She's telling police, like, I heard two pops, and then my mom screamed, and then I heard some more pops. And then on the 911 call, we hear her father start screaming. And she's yelling back to him, Dad, I'm okay, I'm okay. And so now we have the detective, who is Bill Cordes. He's the lead detective, and he is going to interview her and take over the case. Now, this takes place in Markham, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked this up, and they have zero crime.
Like, yeah, well, Canada generally has super low crime rate, and I think Markham is like a nice small town.
Yeah, like I live in Scranton. Well, I live a little north of Scranton, but Scranton itself, I think there's maybe 70, 75,000 people and it's pretty sleepy. Mm-hmm. And our crime rate is like triple what theirs was. I was stunned to see how small it was. So he's the lead detective and he says, you know, I was just falling asleep and I got the call. And he seems real annoyed that he got pulled out of bed. And he's like, you know, we have a very low crime rate and now we have a double shooting and it's violent. It's always so fascinating to me how, like, when I'm watching, say, British police shows, right?
Mm-hmm.
The absence of gun violence is so palpable. It's like almost working with negative space, like the absence of something being so powerful. And it's so interesting to me how a double homicide in America, I mean, that's Wednesday. You know what I mean? Like this is, and they're acting like this is insane.
Yeah, it's the biggest crime that happened in the town probably in a long time.
Right. And I also feel, and I don't know if you picked up on this, the police are so gentle with these people. I was like, this is wild.
Well, even the detective Deborah Gladding, who's the victim liaison officer, the way that she's like so concerned about Jennifer's mental health, and I think at one point she even drives her home, I was just like, these are Canadian services. We don't have that in our justice system.
What is happening? So the victims are Big Pan and Hand Pan. Hand Pan? Han Pan? No, it's Hand Pan.
Yeah.
And Big is dead. and Han is shot in the head in critical condition. Bic is Jennifer's mother and Han is Jennifer's father. They're mm-hmm. Vietnamese immigrants who, by all accounts, lived a pretty quiet life. And Jennifer's their daughter. She has an older brother. They never even mention him in the documentary.
Yeah, I saw that she has an older brother. He's an engineer. And yeah, they never mention him at all.
No, nothing. No. Like, I guess he wasn't in the house. But still, I'd like to hear from him. Like, do you right. think your sister killed your parents or tried to kill your parents?
Yeah, well, I saw that they actually asked Han and the brother, and both of them declined.
Okay. Is it Han or Han? Am I saying it?
You know, I have no idea.
I thought it was Han Pan because I thought it rhymed.
I think you're probably right. But let's go with that. Bad.
Okay. All right. So Randy Slade is the interviewer here. And Jennifer, so this is day one, the initial interview. They've just brought her in. And mm-hmm. she tells them, my mom was making dinner because she was getting ready to go line dancing, as you do. And Jen, remember line dancing? Like that yeah. was a huge thing in the 90s. Oh my God. Like I remember Billy Ray Cyrus. What was it? Achy Breaky Heart.
Achy Breaky Heart. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
My second grade class did a lot of line dancing to Achy Breaky Heart.
So Jennifer then says she had dinner with her mom. She goes upstairs. She's on the phone with her friend chatting. Around 9:30, mom gets home and Jennifer hears mom calling out for dad. She mm-hmm. says she sticks her head out of her room and there's a man there who ties her hands behind her back and he has a gun. And he says, if you cooperate, no one has to get hurt. And he's like, where's your money? Where's your money? Where's your money? She says, three men dragged me down the stairs and asked my mom where her purse was. My mom was trying to get up and her English isn't good, so she was not understanding what they were saying. She says, they then took her back upstairs and tied her hands to a banister, like yeah. a railing. I haven't heard it called banister in a long time. It's a railing, right?
I know. Yeah, it is a railing, but I knew what you meant.
When I was a kid, though, we lived on a second floor in an apartment, and we called uh-huh. it a banister.
Yeah, I know it being called that as well. I don't know. Yeah. Somewhere in the early 2000s, it seems like it phased out to railing.
Wherever people picked up on accident.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. God damn it. Quest of my lifetime. So she says the men took her parents downstairs, and they're screaming, you lied to us, you lied to us, and she heard pops. Mom mm-hmm. screams, more pops. Here's where I wrote, the cops are so gentle with her. They're like offering her water, trying not yeah. to upset her. And they don't want to cause her any more trouble or any more trauma. We meet Deborah Gladding, the victim liaison. She's like, hey, I'm just here to make sure Jennifer's okay. I'm like, this is yeah. wild. This yeah. is wild.
Yeah.
Gladding says she felt for Jennifer and what she experienced was really traumatic. I mean, she was tied up. She was separated from her parents. Jennifer is asked to describe the guy. This is cringy to me, who tied yes. her up. And of course she says he's black with dreads. Like we see this a lot.
Yeah, that really, really bothered me. She just, you see that she kind of really doesn't have any kind of concern to like put someone's life in danger like that, you know, with law enforcement's biases. They could have easily put someone in jail based off of what she said. And she didn't really seem to care. But then again, she also tried to get her parents killed. So there's that.
True. There's that. So she says, oh, there was another black guy with a Jamaican accent like this. And this reminds me of, did you see Murders in Boston?
I didn't see that. No,
it was a documentary that was out maybe last year. It was really good. And it was about this famous murder case in Boston mm-hmm. where this affluent white guy from a rich family, and he's getting married, and or maybe he is married. He is married. They're married like a year or two. This happened in like the 70s or 80s. He calls 911, starts with the 911 call, very similar to this. And he's like, my pregnant wife has been shot. We're in a car. Somebody carjacked us, a black guy, you know, jumped in, held a gun to us, blah, blah, blah. Well, guys, sorry, I'm going to blow this open for everybody. Turns out that he did it, that he killed his wife.
Oh my gosh.
But like he blamed it on the black community. So it's all about how the police, who were mostly white in Boston at the time, really just harassed these communities of color, like looking for these perpetrators.
Right.
And they were throwing all these people in jail, and they were all Black men, of course. Yeah, and it was really wild. And it goes into, it's like three episodes. And the first episode is all about like the historical prejudice and bigotry in the Boston mayoral office.
Wow.
And in the police department. So like, it's the perfect storm for this to happen. Wow. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to put that in my queue.
Yeah. It's a good documentary. I would love to cover it. Like, it's so fascinating because it's, I'm very interested in failure of systems a lot of time. And this is definitely that. So again, she's like, you know, it was all these Black guys. And she says she has no idea how they got into the house. She didn't see anything. And the detective's like, if the parents had money, and, you know, I don't understand how they didn't really take, like, there was a wallet there that had $20 bills in it. They didn't take that. They didn't take other valuables. So he's like, I don't think the parents, like, I don't think this was robbery, he's basically saying.
And at first when I thought, you know, they're talking all this talk about money, I thought maybe this was some kind of like drug deal gone wrong. Maybe she was involved with Daniel Wong somehow with some drug stuff and they were really trying to collect, but it didn't seem that way at all.
Yeah. They talk about like dad drives a Mercedes, mom drives a Lexus, but like, you know, a Lexus is a $40,000 or $50,000 car. I mean, yes, it's very nice, but it's not a Jaguar, you know what
I mean? Right.
So the detective's like, it just doesn't make sense because she was like a supervisor. He was a machinist. I mean, their home was nice, but it was nothing crazy. You know, it was your average like two bedroom or three bedroom, two bath home. And so again, he's saying, you know, the wallet's not taken and expensive cameras left behind. Like all these things that would have indicated it was a robbery are not adding up. So day two, we meet Hong, I think his name is Ngo, N-G-O, a friend who says the Pan seemed like an average family. Oh, I'm sorry, it's her. And she would spend a lot of time with them. And she says they were generous. They were hardworking. She says, this is funny. She goes, Hannah's not involved in the mafia or drinking. Okay, those are two positives. Like, I don't know. I guess I just... I'm like, wow, those are two extremes. So they start canvassing the area and they're asking neighbors for information. When they get a break, they learn about Danny Wong. This guy is trouble.
Yeah.
And he's a drug dealer and they find out he's recently been in a relationship with Jennifer, a detail she left out.
Yeah, conveniently.
So they bring him in and he says, yes, I got caught trafficking 2 years ago, but like I've been an angel ever since.
Yeah, I loved that. He's like, oh, you know, the first time I got in trouble, I just decided that's it for me.
Yeah. And like the first time you're in trouble is drug trafficking.
Yeah.
That's pretty serious.
Yeah.
So am I right? Like what would that entail? That would entail like selling drugs, right? Moving stuff?
Moving drugs, I think. Yeah.
But like, does it have to be a large quantity? It's not like I go to your house and I pick up a $50 bag of weed and I bring it back to my house. It's, I feel like it's got to be a little bit more than that.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how it works in Canada, but if I had to guess, I would say that it's probably moving a large amount across maybe state lines. So they have like provinces. So I think so I think that maybe Markham or parts of Markham might be not in the same province as Toronto, but I could be wrong. So it might be just kind of moving it around the state lines there.
That makes sense. So he says he and Jen were boyfriend, girlfriend until about 2 years ago. And he says, we wanted to stay together, but her parents were a problem. And now we're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they were super strict. He says they didn't approve of me not making any money. And he says Jennifer wanted to be together, but he told her, I can't do it because your parents don't want us to be together. And by the way, I have a new girlfriend named Christine.
Yeah.
This is never good.
So sad. No, not at all.
Never good.
Not a totally unique story, but very sad for Jennifer.
I'm trying to think. Didn't we just see? Oh, what was that one we just covered with Ace and Caitlin? Killer, Stalker, Lover?
Lover, Stalker, Killer, I think. Yeah.
Very similar. There we go.
Yeah, exactly.
So he says Jennifer still calls him quite a bit because we're bonded because we're getting harassed by private phone calls.
Uh-huh.
That had
more on that. Yeah. More on that. That had the lover
killer stalker vibe.
Right.
So he says up until about 2 days ago, then it mysteriously stopped. And he's mm-hmm. like, he would call or they would call. He'd answer. They'd hang up. And it happened so much. And he says the people were texting us. They were saying, we're watching you. He's like, they would see me and Jennifer together. I would get a text saying, what is she doing there? Then he gets a text that says, bang, bang, bang. And the cops are all like, this sounds sketch.
Yeah. And also something very weird that Jennifer wouldn't have told them earlier. If she's receiving all these messages and she knows that Danny is, sort of strange. She wouldn't have mentioned that.
To me, that is one of the most damning things. Mm-hmm. Like, if she were innocent and this just happened, that would mm-hmm. be the first thing out of her mouth. Somebody's been threatening me.
Well, so when I put my lawyer hat on, I kind of think once you start talking about text messages, then it gives the cops the ability to get a warrant for her phone and see her text messages. And maybe she didn't, you know, she knew that and didn't want that to happen, but I don't know.
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. So Danny says, look, I'm very confident that has nothing to do. This has nothing to do with my drugs because no one's going to shoot you over marijuana.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a huge documentary about the pot camps in the Pacific Northwest, like a couple years back, about all the violence?
That sounds familiar. That sounds familiar, but I don't recall.
I think people have shot each other over marijuana. I'm just going to throw that out there. I think it's
Yeah. Maybe they don't in Canada. Who knows?
True. So I just feel like they don't really shoot each other in Canada. It is such a polite country.
Exactly.
So they start investigating now Jennifer's friends and her past. And a friend of hers says, oh, God, her and Danny were like super dramatic, back mm-hmm. forth all the time. He's like, he was not a good dude. Not a good dude.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder what it would look like if they got some of my friends and exes to like talk about each other on camera. Yeah. What a disaster it would be. So
don't commit a crime. It probably won't happen if you don't.
Yeah. No, I'll try not to. They have one piece of evidence at this point. It's a very grainy piece of video from a neighbor's camera. And they see three suspects entering the front door and then leaving 30 minutes later. The detective says, though, there was no forced entry, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. Like, they lock their doors a lot there.
Well, you know, so my sister's husband grew up in Canada, and he said for most of his childhood, they wouldn't lock the doors. But so it is interesting. I mean, Jennifer's a lot younger than my sister's husband. So mm-hmm. maybe in those 10 years or so, they decided to start doing that. But yeah.
For a very long time, when we first built our house and moved up to the country, we didn't lock our doors. Mm-hmm. Then I started realizing how public all this information is of where people live and da da da. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to lock my doors. And my in-laws are right across the way. And my father-in-law was like always looking out the window, always knew what was going on. And since he passed, I feel like, okay, we really need to keep everything locked down here. So now we have cameras, we have doors locked. Yeah. And I think part of that too is having teenagers. Mm-hmm. You're just like, I need to know if these bitches are sneaking out. Like, I need to know what's going on here. So,
well, you know what? What else I found was interesting was that the friend said that she worked for the entire summer and made like a few thousand dollars and decided to buy a paintball gun for Daniel with $2,000.
Yes.
Because she said that there's no one better she could spend it on, including herself, which I felt was like super sad. You start to see she's kind of very obsessed with him, and seems to have a lot of self-esteem issues.
Yeah, she's obsessed with him. We'll get there, but the situation she's growing up in is such an intense pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. She probably just felt that this guy accepted her for who she was.
Yeah.
And that is a bond. And this is another thing like I struggle with as a parent is there have been boyfriends that my daughters brought home that were not too keen on. Mm-hmm. And it's like you can't you have to be really careful there, because not that my daughter would have us murdered, although you never know, but you don't want to create an us against them situation, right, like an us right. against the world bond.
Right.
And I am like, I'm living proof of that. That was my mm-hmm. whole first marriage. My parents mm-hmm. didn't approve. They pushed me into like, I'm going to prove you wrong. I'm going to marry yeah. this guy, you yeah. know, and it was a whole thing. And it's like, and I don't think they intentionally did that. They just wanted better for me.
Right.
But
right.
I saw it as, you don't trust my choice. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to stick this path out.
And in the beginning of this story, you kind of feel like, oh, that's so sad. Her parents didn't like him because he didn't make enough money for them. But then you kind of see, well, maybe they didn't like him because he's a drug dealer. And that's not that odd, you know?
Right. So they have the piece of evidence. They're trying to figure this out. They're not getting any leads from that. So Detective Gladding now, for the second interview, says, we really wanted to create a safe space for Jennifer, for her to be honest. I'm like, what? What?
Yeah.
Get in there and beat her head off the table and start screaming. What are you doing?
Yeah.
So they talk about Danny, and she admits, okay, yeah, we had a tumultuous relationship and my parents didn't want us to date. They ask her about the drugs. She says, I never asked too many questions. Now they ask her, like, is his girlfriend messaging you? Like, who's messaging you? She blames it on the girlfriend.
Yeah.
She says.
But gently.
Gently, yeah. Yeah. Very subtly. Very, like, well, somebody doesn't want me with Danny.
Yeah. And she says, I don't know for sure. So
I don't want to point fingers.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She says, but I'm telling you right now, the girl has messaged me on Facebook before and told me I was stupid. So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
She tells Detective Cordes that her father found out about this relationship and gave her an ultimatum to choose between her family and Daniel, and she chose her family. One of the things I have a hard time here is, and this could be a cultural thing, a generational difference.
Mm-hmm.
She is like 22. Yeah. Why are they having such control over her life? But I think it might be a cultural situation.
I think it is somewhat of a cultural situation. So I'm the daughter of immigrants as well. My dad came from Pakistan to the U.S. in 1970 for an engineering program at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So I think there's like a lot of pressure to optimize for financial stability, because a lot of these people don't really have anyone to fall back on. And they're oftentimes taking care of people back home or helping. My dad, for example, he helped his siblings get established. He's like the oldest of eight.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So I think there is a lot of pressure. So a lot of this, you know, to an extent, some of this seemed normal, like really wanting her to succeed, wanting to see her grow. I think also in immigrant communities, there's a lot of concern about what other people in the community think of you
mm-hmm.
and your children and what they're doing. And so there's also a lot of privacy/secrecy that comes with that. If there's anything kind of negative, they don't want that to be known. And so I think there's so much more at play here, and they really don't go into the dynamics of the relationship between the family. At one point she kind of mentions she used to cut herself, which is like, I think a trauma response.
Yep.
So I wonder, like, what has she been through that's kind of causing that? And they really don't go into much of that.
I have some of that. I'll share it later. But Jennifer failed, in her opinion, at a lot of this. And I think she had a lot of self-shame and doubt. And it's really, really sad.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like just her strengths seem to be sort of artistic. And like, I know she was really good at ice skating and she got injured. And so she didn't get to do that.
She was really good at piano, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. But I also remember in the documentary them saying that she wasn't really good at school. And I think maybe that's where
her parents had conflict. She didn't even graduate high school. We'll get to it. Okay.
Mm.
So she tells Cordes, you know, she chose her family, but they still, her and Danny were still talking secretly, and they got caught. And her parents took away her cell phone and drove her everywhere. And Jennifer doesn't really leave the house now. And she does take piano lessons, but her dad drives her to and from. And I think she teaches piano lessons as well. Mm-hmm. Her piano teacher at this point says she was the best of the best. Like, she was so talented. And he said her parents dumped a ton of money into her mm-hmm. piano playing. And then one day he says she started to sob at her lesson and said, "My parents don't trust me. They follow me. They hate my boyfriend and they hate Danny because he's a loser." So, yeah. I mean, that's a break. And my heart broke for her when I was hearing this because imagine, like, you are backed so far into a corner that, mm-hmm. and I've been here and I'm sure you have, where a stranger, like, you just, not that he's a stranger, but he's not somebody you would normally confide in. You just, you just lose it and you break down.
Yeah, it's just, it's really sad. She just seems so under pressure and that she was really controlled and not trusted. Mm-mm. And, you know, I mean, we know how the documentary ends, so it's not that unreasonable, I guess, but it's kind of a chicken and egg situation of, like, what came first.
Yeah. Hey, everyone, stay tuned. Little Miss Recap will be right back after these words.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So Jennifer says that Danny helped her through a really hard time in high school. So they went to Europe on a band trip and they were mm-hmm. playing in this music hall and it was smoky and her asthma acted up and she had a really, really bad asthma attack and he took care of her. And that's when their relationship went from friend to something more. And the detective says, "So you still have feelings for Daniel, don't you?" And she says, "Yes." So mm-hmm. we learn that after high school, Jennifer wanted to do kinesiology, but that wasn't good enough. Dad wanted her to be something more. So he wanted her to be a pharmacist. I think he would have wanted her to be a doctor.
Right, right. But she couldn't stomach it, apparently.
Yeah, she couldn't deal with blood and same girl, same. That's the only reason, Chubnum, that I'm not a doctor is because I can't deal with blood. So I was like, let me be a poet instead. So peers say that there was an intense pressure in their immigrant community to be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, or something of that stature. And this guy that they're talking to, one of her friends, says she wasn't a good student. Like she wasn't.
Yeah.
She wasn't an academic.
Yeah. Right.
And Jennifer says she never got into university for pharmacy, but she lied to her dad and told him she was going to school. And she lied to both of her parents. And the detective actually says, and this is a big, big curse word for this guy, "You got to be shitting me." It's like, whoa. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So now we learn that her parents were driving her to Toronto for school, but she wasn't going.
So what did she do with all that money they were giving her for college?
Okay. So let me get into this a little bit. So there's this article that was written by an acquaintance of hers. Mm-hmm. For Toronto Life. And it's kind of cited around the internet as the seminal article on Jennifer Pan. So they get into, let me go down to where this woman starts talking about Jennifer.
I was like, maybe she bought a bunch more paintball guns. I don't know.
All I know is she was 5'7". And to me, that's a giant. How tall are you?
Oh, I'm 5'3". So that is a giant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So here, this woman writes, and I want to give this woman credit, Karen Ho. Okay. So Karen writes that Jennifer had been a top student in elementary school, but midway through grade 9, she was only averaging 70% in all subjects, with the exception of music, where she excelled. So she used old report cards, scissors, glue, and a photocopier to create new forged report cards with straight A's. Since universities didn't consider marks from grade 9 through 10 for admission, she told herself it wasn't a big deal.
That's very different from the U.S. We have, you know, grade 9 and 10 definitely count.
Oh, yeah. Her parents were really strict. And by age 22, she had never even gone to a club.
Wow.
Been drunk or visited a friend's, like, getaway house or been on vacation without her family. Their overprotectiveness was born of love and concern. To Jennifer and her friends, however, it was tyranny. They were absolutely controlling, said a former classmate who asked not to be named. They treated her like shit for such a long time. Yikes.
Yeah, they, you know, it's one thing to be protective, but that seems to have crossed over the line into extremely controlling. Yep. The fact that she, what I wonder is, was she supposedly living at home while she was going to school? Because
yeah, that's what I have. Hold on, I'm trying to find it. Okay, so basically what she was doing is, here we go. Jennifer's parents, the university. Okay, so she received early acceptance to Ryerson, but she had failed calculus in her final year and wasn't able to graduate. The university withdrew its offer. Desperate to keep her parents from figuring this out, she lied and said she was starting at Ryerson the fall. So she never completed that calculus class, so she never had a high school diploma. So she says she's going to Ryerson, and her plan was to do 2 years of science there, then transfer to University of Toronto's pharmacology program. Okay. So she collected used biology and physics textbooks and brought home school supplies. In September, she pretended to attend Frosh Week. I don't know what that is. When it came to tuition.
Like freshman orientation, orientation kind of thing. Yeah.
When it came to tuition, she doctored papers stating that she was receiving loans and convinced her dad she'd won a scholarship. She would pack up her book bag, take public transportation downtown. Her parents assumed she was headed to class. Instead, she would go to the library and research on the internet specific relevant scientific topics and fill her books with notes. This is a lot of effort to go through.
Yeah, she could have studied something she wanted to. Exactly, exactly. Do something you want to do, you
know. But the problem is, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It just seems like she's really obsessed with pleasing her parents or nothing. She can't seem to even recognize what she wants for her own life, which is super sad.
She earned money. She would spend her free time at cafes or visiting Daniel, but she picked up a few day shifts as a server at a pizza shop. She taught piano lessons. She tended bar. And at home, Han would often ask Jennifer how her studies are going, but Bick was like, don't interfere. Like, let her do her thing, da, da, da. And then she ended up staying. Okay, here it is. She suggested moving in with a friend, Topaz, downtown for 3 nights a week so she could be closer, because this was at the point she supposedly was transferring to the University of Toronto.
Okay.
So they were like, okay, yeah, it's a long commute. You could stay with Topaz, but she never did. She was staying with Danielle and his parents at his home. So they like almost lived together.
Right.
So this was way more serious than boyfriend, girlfriend.
Right.
So after 2 more years, they eventually find out about her. And how they find out about it is she said that she was volunteering at a blood testing lab called Sick Kids. And so she was saying that she was gone all the time, but her father noticed she had no uniform or key card. So they dropped her off one day. They were getting suspicious. They dropped her off and very Casey Anthony going to Universal Studios adjacent. Yeah. They like follow her in and they realize like the gig is up. You're not.
No
doing
one knows
anything.
Her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they even called Topaz, and Topaz was like, she's not here. What are you talking? She doesn't live here. What are you talking about? So they get into this big thing. He told Jennifer, Han kicked Jennifer out, told her never come back, but Bick convinced him to let her stay. They took away her stuff. So like this happened kind of right before the murder.
Okay.
So this huge blow up.
So all the dominoes are falling and her like lies are being discovered.
Yep. And so then finally, you know, she plans this murder. Well, let me get back to my notes because this comes out.
Okay. She could have turned all her document forging expertise into a career of graphic design or art or something.
What was that movie? Catch Me If You Can.
Catch Me If You Can. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yep. So they start asking for further details about the 911 call, and they actually make her reenact how she could have done this.
Yeah.
With her hands tied behind her back. Like, how did you get the phone out?
Yeah, I thought they were going to get her on that, but she was able to do it.
She was able to do it. She must have thought about it. Like, do you
maybe,
think,
yeah.
Do you think at this point she's starting to sense that they're onto her a little bit?
I think so. And I think that she's kind of just had so much practice as a liar that
yeah, that's true.
She's had a lot of practice thinking through how to make stories up.
Yep. They ask her if her parents have life insurance policies, and she says she had one on herself and her parents had one on her, but they cashed it in and used it for her education. But when they found out she lied about university, they asked for the money back, and the detective's like, hold up. They found out you lied. And she's like, yeah. I told them for 2 years. And like, she just, we're seeing now that everything was crumbling.
Yeah, and this is where I hear Ace Fanning in my head saying, you got to look at the life insurance policy.
You always have to look at the life insurance policy. So they're pretty sure Jennifer – see, my parents neither one of them – this was a shock to me. Neither one of my parents have life insurance. So nobody come and murder them, because I don't even know if I could afford to bury them. So there we go.
They didn't want to give you any kind of incentive.
No,
so.
They didn't. Yeah. They didn't. I don't even know – like. You know, obviously now they're divorced and they're older. I don't know if they had life insurance when we were growing up. Maybe. Oh, you know what? I'm assuming they had it through work.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
But no. Timmy's parents, meanwhile, are like so ready for all that shit. They have like life insurance. Everything's in place. Like when his father died, it was like, okay, let's get out the manual. What do we have to do now?
Oh, wow. And,
like, it was wild.
Super planners.
Yeah. It was like Operation, is it London Bridge, when the Queen died? I think it was.
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That's what it was like. So he, okay, they know Jennifer had something to do with this, but there's only one witness, and that's Han. So Han is in an induced coma. He is now taken out of the coma, and he tells them what happened. He says he went to bed early. Jennifer was home. His wife gets home from line dancing, and he's woken up by a guy with a gun. They're brought to the living room. My wife was hysterical. He says he was being pistol whipped. Bic was begging for her life. And here comes Jennifer just bouncing down the steps with one of the guys. And he says they were chatting like they were friends and she was not bound. That was interesting.
Huge.
So now Cordis knows she's involved. He posts officers outside Han's room and does not allow Jennifer near him. Han tells Cordis, use your police techniques to find out what Jennifer did. And there's our title.
This was huge to me. Like, I cannot imagine, I'm not a parent, but I just cannot imagine as a parent, even if this happened, that you would just be so willing to throw your child under the bus like that. I think, you know, you'd want to say, like, I want to talk to my child, you know, and see how they are. And
can I make a sweeping generalization? That's probably going to bring a lot of hate to me.
Okay.
I feel like a father would be more apt to do this than a mother. And I know it's terrible. And there are so many loving fathers out there. My kids have one of them. I have one of them. But like, the dad's just kind of like, just throw her in jail. Like, this is what she did. And the mom, I think would have been like, oh, I got to love her through this. Like, I just have to love her anyway. Just basing it on a lot of true crime stuff that we see. The dads are always like, they're a little tougher. The moms are.
I think so. But I'm still surprised at like how willing he was to right away just throw her under the bus.
Do you think that if you killed your father, that your mother would forgive you?
Oh, for sure.
Do you think if you killed your mother, your father would forgive you? See, you had to think about it.
Yeah.
He might, but you had to think about it.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. Like if I killed anyone, my mother would, except my children. No, she would not forgive me for that. Or my sister.
Yeah.
Her other child.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
But if I killed someone else, my mom would be like, where are we going? Where are we hiding the body? What are we doing?
Yeah.
But if I killed, like, I'm thinking my dad is remarried. If I killed his wife, he probably would not forgive me. He would be real pissed off.
Yeah, that's true. I can see that, yeah.
Just sweeping generalizations here at Little Miss Recap. Okay. So now they bring Jennifer in for this third interview. They're getting real, you know. They bring in a guy named Bill Gates, who's a human lie detector.
Isn't that something? Isn't that Bill interesting? Gates is a lie detector.
And Jennifer tells Bill Gates that she used to self-harm because she was so unhappy. And I have no doubt of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in Canada, Corda says they're allowed to lie to the suspect. Now, are we allowed to do that here? I know that you did a little bit of notes on this.
Yeah, we are definitely allowed to lie. So police lie to suspects all the time. And a lot of times you'll see this where they'll separate two different suspects into two different interrogation rooms and tell them each they're turning on each other to try to get them to confess. But that's totally acceptable. It's interesting, in Canada, they say that police can lie as long as the trickery doesn't go as far as to shock the community. If it goes that far, they'll not allow the statement in the trial.
What does that mean?
I don't know. It's a very fluffy standard, you know, just like the reasonable person standard.
Right.
So, you know, it's pretty subjective. But the standard in the U.S. is actually higher. It has to be that there was evidence of like coercion or that the statement was involuntary in order to get it thrown out of court.
Oh, okay. I got you. So he tells her that a satellite can see movements inside the house and they know that she wasn't where she said she was or something. You know, they start poking holes to her. And this is totally something I would believe. Like you could, you could say anything remotely scientific to me and I'd be like, okay. Okay. They could be like, we put a biome in your geome and your, and just use terms. And I would be like, oh, okay. So, you know, I'm lying.
Well, I know there's a thing called a thermal sensor that they, where they can sense these kinds of like movements in a home. But it sounded weird that he said they could do it via satellite, but
yeah. And why would it already be in place at the time that this happened? It was weird.
Right.
So, she starts to crack and he says, your dad, you know, gave a totally different account. He said there were no black guys. You were not bound. You knew these people, you know, whatever. He starts breaking her down and he's badgering her to admit that she planned this. And she maintains she didn't know these people. And then she whispers and says they were supposed to take me and kill me because I didn't want to live anymore. It's really sad. It's like
super sad.
It's hard to watch. Yeah.
Do you believe that though?
No. No.
Yeah, me either.
And she sobs and tells them that she paid these people. I thought she said $2,000, but later she says $10,000.
I think
maybe that was a down payment.
Maybe. But I thought I thought too it was $2,000 at first. And to me, I was just like, that sounds very low. Like, I know this is 2010. There's been inflation and maybe, you know, Canada's a little cheaper. But that seems like quite a low market rate for such a big crime.
Guys, come at us with murder for hire rates. What are they in today's market? I think that because think about the job she was doing. She probably didn't have $10,000. So she probably said, I'll give you $2,000 now. When I get the insurance money, I'll give you the rest or something like
that.
Oh,
yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
So his name was Homeboy, the guy who she paid this to. And now we start to get the story. They get a warrant for her phone, like you said. And they find a conversation between her and Daniel where he tells her he's in love with Christine. And she's like, then call it off with Homeboy.
Yeah.
And he says, but I thought you wanted this for you. He says, I lined this all up for you. So then they get into Daniel's phone and through surveillance, they end up picking up three suspects. Homeboy is a friend of Danny's and two of his buddies. And they're all kind of involved in this drug dealing and they all get arrested. Meanwhile, Jennifer's insisting still that this is like a hitman gone wrong situation.
Right.
And that she was supposed to be dead. I have a difficult question.
Believable.
I have a difficult question. And I know, like, I was a mental health writer for a while and I did a lot of research on this. And I know that self-harm does not always equal suicidality, right? It's not, there's not a definite connection. But I just feel like if she is trying to claim that she wanted to die, so she hired these guys to do this, that if she already had the propensity to self-harm, would she have not, if she, if the goal was for her to die, if she wouldn't have done it a different way?
That's what I was wondering too. And I feel like I don't know enough about this topic at all, but I would be interested to see how many times, what the statistics are around getting yourself killed versus committing suicide.
Yeah, it's interesting for me. Interesting to me. I know that women mostly commit suicide in nonviolent ways. Mm-hmm. But like, and I also know they tell you one of the first things they tell parents when your kid is self-harming is don't panic. This does not mean suicidality, because that's where your brain goes immediately. So I don't think, I know there's not a correlation, but I can't help but think this is an odd way for this girl to try to take herself out of the equation. I don't know. Right, it's like. Right.
That's why I kind of feel like maybe she wanted it to seem like she got killed, and then that she could just kind of run away with Daniel and start a new life. Yeah,
maybe. So now they're like, they're done. And they said, homeboy texts her and says, game time. She goes downstairs, says goodnight to mom, unlocks the door, goes back upstairs. They have this on that surveillance video that she blinks the lights to give them the signal. They arrest her for murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. It's all over the news. People are horrified. They find her diary, which, can you do this? Can you read someone's diary on a documentary? Jesus.
If they're arrested for murder, you can.
Oh, my God. I'm going to burn every diary I have in my house now, because what if something happens and I can picture like Timmy reading it on the nightly news? So they also believe that she's the one behind the quote unquote stalking text messages. Mm-hmm. So why is Daniel involved? Like, this is what they have to figure out. And the police believe it was financially motivated, that Jennifer was going to come into about $500,000, and he believed that he could manipulate her into accessing it. Handpan says in his ultimatum, he told her, you have to end this relationship or wait until I'm dead to date him.
That's a big one.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Now, but I feel like you can also kind of see Daniel's manipulation of her here. She just seems so willing to do anything for him. And it, I think it goes back to him helping her with her asthma, you know, breakout, that she just feels completely indebted to him after that.
This is a girl that has not experienced much kindness in her life.
I agree.
And I think when, you know, I think we take for granted that your parents are the first people who show you kindness in this world, and when you when you don't get kindness from them, you know what I mean? And I don't think her mother was problematic, but I think the mother tried, but the mother sounds like was so under hands thumb too that she couldn't really. I think she tried to advocate for Jennifer, but I don't think she could. So you know, somebody comes along and shows her kindness, and it's like a drug.
Exactly. And I just also wonder how the brother played into this, where like maybe the brother and the father kind of were very dominant in the family. And maybe Daniel was the first man that did anything nice for her.
Yeah, that's true, too. I don't know. It's sad. It's like it's one of these stories that's just a huge tragedy all around.
Yeah, very much so.
Now they discover that 10 months earlier, Jennifer had approached another person and paid them to kill her father. And it never happened. But the police are like, the intent was there. Like, we see that now.
Yeah.
The cops say, this is really sad. The cops say that Bic Pan begged for the life of her daughter before she was killed.
Oh, yeah.
She's found guilty.
Yeah, see, if Bic survived, I think she wouldn't have given her up to the police the way,
I think
the way
you're right.
The dad did.
I think she probably would have. It probably would have been a Cindy Anthony situation where, like, she knows her daughter did it, but she's in complete denial. Yeah. So this happened in 2010. Jennifer was 24. She was born in 1986. What year were you born?
85.
Oh, there you go. So she's a year younger than you. Yeah. She's found guilty. They are sentenced to life. Jennifer and Daniel and the others are all sentenced to life in prison with no chance for parole for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And Handpan is granted a lifetime no contact order against his daughter. They have appealed their trial, and they're going to get a new trial. And I don't know what they've appealed on. Do you have anything on that?
Well, so the appeal was based off of the fact that the lower court basically presented the options to the jury in a really limited way, basically gave the jury really just two scenarios, one in which the plan was to murder both the parents and another in which the plan was to commit a home invasion and the parents were shot in the course of the robbery. So the court that overturned the, or that required the new trial, basically said the judge really limited what the jury could do. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because in both of those scenarios, they would, it leads to basically a murder conviction, because even where you're doing a home invasion, where you agree to do a home invasion, there are certain crimes, like violent crimes, where if you go to do them and someone dies, you can be held for murder even if you weren't the one that pulled the trigger. So yeah, it's kind of setting the situation up to making it hard for them to get out of that charge, basically.
Oh, I see. Okay. So do we think Jennifer's defense team argued for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they argued for this.
Okay.
Yeah, to say that, you know, maybe there are plenty of other possibilities. Maybe they came in to collect, you know, to, I don't know, hang out with Jennifer, and there was arguments, and it was like a moment of rage, and they killed the parents. Okay. So that would be murder two and not murder one, and the sentence is a lot lighter. So they were basically saying that the initial judge didn't leave room for the possibilities of murder two or manslaughter, and really just kind of led the jury down this murder one path.
Mm. See, I'm glad you're here, because I would not know this. Okay. So what do you think overall? Like, do you think that, I don't know, do you think she's in the right place? Do you think she got an adequate sentence? Do you think it should be like a murder two sitch, or what do you think?
It's hard to know without more information. I would really want to know more about her text messages with Daniel. Mm-hmm. How hard did she try to call it off?
Not hard.
How much did she? It didn't seem like that from the documentary, but I'm wondering if there's any more to that. And, you know, if she can show that she wasn't really in agreement with the conspiracy and she wasn't a part of it, then she has a good chance of getting her sentence, you know, changed and her conviction changed. But it seems like a pretty difficult case.
So here's what this writer writes about that day. So on the afternoon, November 2nd, the plan took a turn. Danielle texted Jennifer saying he felt as strongly about Christine as she did about she did about him. So we saw this in the doc. Right. And suddenly everything was thrown into question. So she texted Daniel, so you feel for her what I feel for you, then call it off with homeboy. He responded, I thought you wanted this for you. She responded, I do, but I have nowhere to go. Daniel wrote back, call it off with homeboy. You said you wanted this with or without me. Jennifer said, I want it for me. The next day, Daniel texted, I did everything and lined it up for you. And then that was it. They says, but within hours, they'd reverted to their old ways, texting and flirting. And later that day, Crawford, texted Jennifer and said, I need time of completion. Think about it. And Jennifer wrote back, today's a no-go. Dinner plans are out, so I won't be home in time. Over the following week, they continued again. And on the morning of November 8th, Crawford texted Jennifer, after work will be game time. And then she did. So she didn't try very hard to call it off.
No, but you kind of wonder, why did she have to be there? Like, why did she say, not today, I have dinner plans? If they were just going to kill her parents, why was she even there? You know, it makes you wonder, maybe she wanted to get kidnapped. Maybe she wanted them to appear to have killed her. Something's off.
That's very true. I never thought of that angle before. Like, why did she have to be there?
Yeah.
Maybe... like, so we're not working with the criminal mastermind here, right?
Right, right.
So maybe she's just like, if I'm there and I'm a victim of the crime, it really seals that I am innocent of this. I can't be tied to it.
That just seems so much more risky.
It seems real risky.
Yeah. You have to answer to the police. You're a witness. You're going to have to, you know, be part of the court case. Whereas if you were just out to dinner, you could be like, I came back and discovered them dead.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean... let's face it, she didn't do a lot of things correctly, and maybe she flubbed up the murder for hire, clearly.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're right. She put herself at big risk, like, because now you have to sit and boldface lie to a police, a detective, rather than just being like, I don't know, you know, the George Costanza thing of, if I believe the lie hard enough, then it becomes true.
Yeah.
That's what she could have done.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, overall, I thought it was okay. Let me put it this way. I'm glad it was an hour and a half documentary, not a 4-hour docuseries.
Oh, yeah. It could have been it like could have 45 been. Minutes.
Yeah, yeah, it could have been.
Yeah.
Well, it could have been. So two things. If they were going to leave out the information that they left out anyway, then yeah, it could have been 45 mm-hmm. minutes.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff that they didn't give us. Like, I want right. to see her faking her whole life downtown.
Yeah, me too. I want to know what she did with the money. Mm-hmm. I want to know where she lived. What was she doing during that time? More about her relationship with Daniel, and then more about her relationship with her family.
Yeah, I really want to know about that too, because this documentary does an interesting, like, just looking at it in by itself, right? Mm-hmm. Apropos of everything else we know, it doesn't really tell us just how bad the parents were. I'm not saying yeah. they deserved it. I'm not saying it's their fault, but to know
right.
the circumstances of that extreme pressure cooker that she was in, mm-hmm. I think yeah. really gives motive. But it right, also, right. you know, kind of explains why she did this, because it's just so.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw this with the Menendez brothers. Like, when kids kill their parents, yeah. it's like so shocking.
Right, right.
And yeah. to have a girl do it, like, that's even yeah. less frequent, less.
Right, right.
I don't know what the word I'm looking for is.
Common.
Thank you. Oh, my God. The word common. All right, girl. I think we've said it all.
Yeah.
Guys, if you haven't already, jump into our Facebook group, Backdoor Friends. We have a lot of fun in there. I'll be announcing a bunch of stuff coming up. We have a lot of true crime stuff coming up. We're doing Love During Lockup. Do you watch that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So we're doing on Patreon Love During Lockup. We're doing 90 Day Love in Paradise. We're back to Sister
Wives. I'm excited
Wives.
About that.
Oh my yeah. God. It's going to be yeah. Love During Lockup this mm-hmm. season. There's somebody from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, which I could drive, get oh, in my wow. car and drive there right now. It's 15 minutes from me. I used to live there.
Nice.
And wow. there is a very prominent gentleman's club there that is featured prominently on the show as part of the storyline. So
very interesting.
Yes. All right. Do you have anything you want to promote? Anywhere you want people to find you, or not really?
Not really. I'm just happy to be here and along for the ride. But yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I'm very happy to have you here, and I'm very glad that you brought a little bit of polish and a little bit of legalese to the show.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Because I just do a lot of surmising and guessing and generalizing. So there's that. All right, guys. Thank you so much. If you want to support the show, please sign up for our Supercast, Patreon, Apple subscriptions, and you'll get some bonus content. You'll get everything ad-free and be part of the fun over there. All right, guys, thank you so much, and we'll see you soon. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.